What's up, guys? I'm Nobody Special, and we had kind of a crazy couple of days in the precious metals market. Unless you've been under a rock, you've probably heard there's a thing going on in that part of the world where things always go on. And so the price action today, and in particular yesterday, was somewhat counterintuitive. I mean, the common wisdom is that during times of geopolitical risk, gold is a safe haven asset, and investors tend to flock to gold. And I mean, if you can't describe these last few days as geopolitical risk, I don't know what qualifies. And yet the price action we've seen was not in accordance with that standard correlation. We've actually seen gold and silver make a pretty big move lower over the last few days. And so we have got Bob Coleman. Bob, you were specifically requested this morning on my morning live stream. We had some people in the super chats suggested I bring you on to talk about what we're seeing in gold. And since then, the price action has gotten even more wacky. So thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us today. And
sure.
So what's going on here? Yeah,
I wish I could ask you that question. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, we kind of talked about a little bit. I think on George Noble's spaces a few days ago, this idea of lack of liquidity that's been developing in the futures markets. And part of this is due to the rising margin rate requirements, you know, the exchange sort of battling volatility and trying to sort of calm the markets or calm volatility for its members, its clearing members, and obviously reducing risk. But what's happened, I think, is there's a combination of things. We can get through all this, but on the futures markets, you're seeing diminished liquidity, diminished open interest. You're seeing metal leaving, for example, the COMEX, metal leaving the Shanghai Futures Exchange. And I think this is all due to a sort of an ongoing battle with metal moving towards best traded for one, you know, basically putting fires out. So, you know, London was very expensive. So metal naturally was moved from New York to London to meet that demand, and arbitrage traders, you know, took full advantage of that and made money doing that, basically selling at a lot higher price over in another region. And just paying the carrying and shipping costs. But I think what's happening right now with these pockets of you know, whether you call it air or gaps in price, I think that's due to the diminished depth of the futures markets and people sort of walking away from that market. You know, whether it's due to volatility, whether it's due to high carrying costs, rising margin rates, and so forth, it's not as cheap to trade anymore a futures contract as it once was. And so that is all acting. So, for example, if you're trading 15 lots of, you know, silver contracts, 5,000 ounces per lot, and you want to go sell, you may get, you know, 3-4 different prices. And that's not providing the hedger, or say, for example, the wholesaler or the retail dealer that is hedging their inventory. All of a sudden, when they have to go place a trade and try to lock in a specific price, they're not getting that price. They're getting sort of an average of various prices. And that just adds more risk to the balance sheet and so forth. And I think this is being amplified, I think, throughout the world. And it's partly due to the volatility that we've seen.
Okay, so that answer left me with probably 6 or 7 more follow-up questions. So I'll start with the easy one here. You mentioned margin requirements played a big factor in some of the big sell-offs we saw within that big bull run last fall into January, culminating with that monster sell-off at the end of January. Have there been any margin changes in the last couple of days that may have contributed at all to this price move?
I not from the CME. There could be from individual clearing members. You know, these broker dealers have the right to, you know, increase margin on their own clients, you know, whereas the exchange sort of provides, you know, underlying margin requirements for its clearing members. So you may have seen some of that activity, but you have to remember, in periods of mass volatility, for example, a large, you know, sell off in the general market, you know, sometimes players are positioned where they have to reach for liquidity, and they sell whatever they can sell. And so I believe that the markets really started to sell off during the Chinese hours. And then it kind of carried through into Europe and then obviously into our markets. And so again, like, we don't know all these players that are working in all these other regions. Like, for example, that the gentleman who is short 450 tons of silver on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. Those types of outliers you don't know about until you read about it in the paper, you know, 3 days after it happened. And so this is what makes the market really dangerous from the short-term side. The short-term trader who trades on margin and leverage, is these guys are being eaten alive. You know, to be extremely delicate on your positioning. You have to be very fine-tuned in terms of, you know, stop losses, and, you know, being willing to get out of a market, you know, and still watch the market move ahead, move higher, even though you're out. You got to be willing to trade for less money or less profits. And that makes, you know, again, liquidity tighter, and it makes the depth of the market, or it impacts the depth of the market itself.
Okay, so I do want to zero in on liquidity, because I have that circled in my notes here, and you've mentioned that a couple of times. But there's one thing that you touched on there that I also want to follow up on. You mentioned metals leaving the Shanghai Futures Exchange, and then you mentioned a sell-off during Chinese trading hours. Now, that's kind of interesting, because most of what I've seen, at least in social media, has been talking about the big premium Chinese metal is getting rewarded with, where, you know, metal trades at a premium over in China, several dollars above U.S. prices, and then even within China, you got the Shanghai Gold Exchange trades a little bit below the Shanghai Futures Exchange, or vice versa. So you're actually seeing physical metal being drained from the Shanghai exchanges as this sell-off was happening? Am I hearing that correctly?
Not necessarily just yesterday, but if you look at December into February, you know, you went from 900 tons to 350 tons of metal that was on the exchange. And from what I read this morning, I think from one of one of the gentlemen that does a lot of work on posting about the Shanghai the Chinese markets, is I think they stopped reporting silver tonnage inventories this morning.
Really?
Which was unusual.
Now, that just happened this morning, you're saying?
Yeah. So I think they have what they call some kind of weekly report or something like that, and so they stopped reporting on silver. So I don't know if it was just an anomaly, or if it's, you know, potentially some type of new policy that they have. But yeah, this
we're
is
gonna
the
go ahead
impact.
And, we're going to go ahead and put that on then. So yeah, it's never good news when the Chinese stop reporting it, right? I mean,
you can trust all those numbers. Yeah.
Not that ours are any better, but.
Yeah. Well, especially when you know, it's 3 a.m. and all of a sudden a server goes down.
That cooling issue again, drat.
Yeah.
Every time.
And that's another issue. You know, last week you had an outage happen right into a significant closing period on the CME or the COMEX at that 130 level. You know, that's not something that happens every day. And so it makes it more difficult, I think, for traders, you know, not taking away the conspiratorial side or the, you know, what's really going on behind the scenes or who's, you know, moving the levers behind the curtains type of thing. But just from a trader's perspective, when you start seeing these things happen, you're automatically going to throw your guard up, and you're going to be much more defensive. You're going to take smaller positioning. You're going to be much more akin to any squiggles in the market. And that, again, when you magnify that across the board with traders in general, you know, whether they're trading silver futures, SLV, SLV options, whatever it may be, you start to see the trading volume start to drop.
Okay. Midnight just came in here, started attacking my feet. I think he's got questions about that 900 tons down to 350 tons that you mentioned. Is that, I mean, do they delineate registered eligible like we do here? Is this just ETFs gobbling up all the metal, or?
That was basically what they had reported on a daily or weekly basis on the Shanghai Futures Exchange, not the Shanghai Gold Exchange. So
Okay.
that was a number that has been provided by the exchange directly.
So that's metal specifically backing up futures
Right.
contracts in Shanghai. So a little bit of liquidity issues developing there. And then the fact that they stopped reporting it, all right, this is coming in handy there. That's interesting. Something else, let's just go to the liquidity subject, because that was kind of front and center in my mind. This morning I'm looking at the market. Stocks go down 1,200 points to start the day. Stocks are selling off, but bonds are selling off along with it. And then gold was selling off. So typically, when you see stocks selling off, you would think it's a flight to safety. But in a flight to safety, people tend to be running towards gold and people tend to be running towards treasuries. But they weren't doing that today. They were selling everything. And then we had somebody asking in Twitter earlier about the strong dollar. We did see the Dixie surge quite a bit over the last couple of days. We started at 97.65 on Friday's close, 99.07 as of a few minutes ago. So that does, the only thing I could think of was possibly a liquidity event brewing in the market as a whole, not just within the metals market. When you see a run to cash, that kind of screams liquidity. The only thing I could think of, obviously what's happening in the Middle East is affecting things, but we've also had this blow up in private credit that's been happening over the last couple of weeks. And I don't know if this is yet a big enough problem that it might spill over into the metals market. These investors running to cash from private credit or people selling whatever they can to raise money to meet redemptions. Do you hear in your circles among metals traders and wholesalers, does anybody even bring up private credit? Has it even entered the conversation yet?
Not really. In our world, you're really more focused on positioning. How the banks are positioned. In terms of, if they're providing liquidity to the market, if they're pulling back from the market. But yeah, what you're kind of talking about is more of a macro theme that, and I think you probably, in part nailed the market. When you said basically everything sold off today except the dollar, that's kind of like 2008-ish in terms of sometimes and this is something I always worry about is the US government or the Fed or whatever it may be to in order to do a rug pull which would help maybe give strength to the dollar, everything else has to go down. And in a way, it's during a time of war like we're seeing right now, and you're seeing things potentially not going to plan. Maybe things aren't as they weren't going to be finite as fast as we had thought or as Israel thought, whatever it may be. All of a sudden, you got to maybe make the dollar look a lot better than maybe the world is seeing it. So you got to sometimes pull that rug. And that could have been what happened today. It's again, I think we all kind of understand this whole game has been liquidity driven, and the Fed has been pumping in money into the markets, $40 billion a month. These guys all realize the financial plumbing needs liquidity to keep these gears working. The scary part is, I think we're all under this sort of guise that, hey, listen, they're just going to keep printing. But there are points in time where the rug gets pulled or players just get too levered out. And like you'd mentioned, it could be private credit, could be the technology stocks, it could be financials. Financials were getting crushed the last couple of weeks. Financials were actually a bellwether for potentially a downdraft in the markets as well. Because usually, if the financials are doing poorly, they are sort of a lead for the entire market.
So could we have a situation where these financial firms, right, all these guys are getting caught up in this like MFS thing or Market Financial Solutions that went bad in London? They're still digesting some of Jamie Dimon's cockroaches in the private credit market. I mean, could these guys just be selling anything under the sun to raise the cash, contributing to the strength in the dollar, contributing to the sell-off in assets across the board?
Definitely. It could be very simple as just like you said, delevering. Trying to hedge, maybe put on hedges, and that activity is putting pressure onto the market. This obviously, whenever you have conflict, especially like we're seeing in the Middle East, and you see Europe and everyone sort of arming up, or even France is getting into the picture, it seems like that makes people worried. And sometimes cash is king. It doesn't mean it's the perfect place to be over the long term, but sometimes you do have cash as a strategic or tactical asset to go to when things get really rocky. But I think in the metals, if we're just going to keep this to the metals, I think the problem is stemming from this developing declining open interest, declining activity, trading volume, and so forth. And I think, and I was going to do a very in-depth piece, I was going to put this out on Twitter or X, sorry, trying to explain what we've been seeing over the last year. Like, you get these 8 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock in the morning sell-offs, like on a daily basis. And I think I've kind of figured out what was going on here, especially after reading, after reading, that Jane Street took an enormous large position in SLV, became the number one shareholder in SLV. And then reading how India, for example, has come down on them for interactions in their markets. And you start to realize, wait a second, the options market, VXSLV, the volatility, implied volatility on an SLV through the roof, option activity through the roof. And you can make, what I'm trying to do is kind of put together an architecture of, okay, how does a high frequency trading or algorithmic type of trading firm, when they come into a commodity like silver and using SLV and potentially using the options market really as its money maker and using the underlying to basically push the markets in different directions to obtain the positioning and sizing, to build that option position, and then all of a sudden, let the market run the other direction. These are the types of things that I kind of get into. And it's not to say, the banks are the bad guys. The banks are just going to, they're there to kill the precious metals markets. I don't think that's always the case. I think, they actually make more money when the metals are going up, I think, than they do when they're going down. But looking at how the options markets progressed, especially in January, when you had, October, you had borrowing fees to borrow SLV shares was through the roof. It was like 20%. I've never seen that before. And then all of a sudden that October timeframe settled down. Lease rates were really high. There was a lot of stress in the markets. And then we got to December, the market started walking back up, and into January took off. But what was interesting was there was no real stress on the borrowing fees on SLV. There was no stress really in the lease rates. Metal was flowing out of the COMEX over to London. So the EFP was somewhat contained. There wasn't that type of stress either. But what was interesting was the premiums on implied volatility on options just went through the roof. Mm. And short sale volume went through the roof. And it didn't make any sense. The only way it made sense to me is if you take someone that has a 20 million share position long, and they can then, there's an old strategy. I apologize because I've been in the markets, I think, forever, it feels like. But back in the 90s, there was if you took your Series 7 exam, there's a thing called short against the box. And the IRS has kind of said this is a no-no. Basically, what happens is you're long a stock, for example, and all of a sudden you short the equivalent amount of shares against your long position. You don't sell the long position, but you just short it to basically hedge it. And the IRS says you can't really do that because you're actually in essence you're trying to protect your profit, and that profit is ours to tax. And so they kind of poo-pooed the idea. But if you take that concept, and let's just say you're a large, unnamed participant that owns 20 million shares of SLV, for example.
Okay.
You take that position, and all of a sudden, that long position traded on margin now is a bank to loan against or borrow against shares. And so now you can short with a pool of shares that you don't have to go out and try and find the borrow, you know, and run the borrowing rate up. The borrowing rate stays very dead, but because you have this pool of long shares in your account, now all of a sudden you can short the market down, take positions on the call side, for example. Let's just say you want to bleed the market down a little bit in the morning and all of a sudden build a call position. And all of a sudden, you know, the market then, you know, that artificial short selling stops, and all of a sudden the market starts to return back up into its, you know, former trend. Now, all of a sudden, you're using leveraged options, or that leverage that options provides, to accentuate the profits. Unlike just simply owning SLV itself that goes up dollar for dollar, options may go up, you know, on a multiple of that dollar.
All right. So that is interesting. And Jane Street was on my list that I wanted to ask you about. And honestly, I'm a little surprised. I don't take this the wrong way. I was expecting you to be a little more dismissive of the Jane Street theory that's been going around. We'll say conspiracy theory, you know, the guy in the tinfoil hat calling anything a conspiracy theory. I guess that's hilarious. But Jane Street has been accused of doing this with stocks in India. Jane Street is currently being sued for doing this with Bitcoin and the IBIT Bitcoin ETF. And we are learning that Jane Street is the biggest single holder of shares of SLV. So they could have gone, borrowed money, bought all these SLV shares, and then they're using this to carry out this complex trade, trading short against the box, as you described, to create these intraday swings. And then they profit from the correction on that. And then they could do it over and over again. And this is a big outfit. I mean, they could, small moves in price could be immensely profitable for an outfit like Jane Street here, couldn't they?
Right. And it's not just the moves. It's not just the intrinsic value of the option. What you saw was an increasing, you know, and it's accentuated by a gamma squeeze, but it's the accentuated move of the implied volatility, which adds even more value to that option. So you're actually compounding the value of that option move with, you know, rising intrinsic value, rising volatility premium. This is where it gets kind of interesting, because when I'm starting to look at all this stuff yesterday and I started to type this stuff out, I'm like, from the surface, it makes no sense. You're seeing massive short sell volume in January, but yet the borrowing fee has been steady at 0.4 to 0.6%.
Where were they getting the shares to short? They right. already had them, right?
Yes. Yes, you didn't need to go out to the market to find them. And when you can use that pool of liquidity, you can take advantage of it. Now, this is where I think what we're kind of seeing with the markets since President Trump has taken office is you've seen a sort of deregulatory type of atmosphere that makes me really nervous that these markets are becoming more deregulated by the day. For example, the CFTC article that I posted, where basically in Chicago, you know, they had 20 securities attorneys, 19 were fired, and the last one quit in protest. There is nobody, you know, it used to be, you know, maybe the fox is guarding the hen house. There is absolutely nobody guarding the hen house now. I mean, it's kind of scary. And if you're going to pull guard, so to speak, or pull the you know, if you're talking about hockey, and, you know, you're pulling the goalie because you got to score that last goal. Well, you're pulling the regulators out. It allows a lot of room for potentially artificially marking up the market and potentially putting the public at risk, because players know that, okay, if nobody's really watching me, I can, you know, the cost of doing business, I can run this market and control a position. You know, maybe claim, hey, listen, I'm not manipulating the market, but because of my positioning and size, I'm definitely influencing the market. But you don't have anybody watching that being able to, you know, dissect the trades and that type of thing, and trying to understand their trade book relative to other people's trade books and so forth. And so that this is where It's a very dangerous precedent. And this is what the 1920s really was all about, the stock operator days of market manipulation, painting the tape, all those kind of things. And of course, it culminated in the 1929 top, and then everything fell apart. And that's why we had, the Securities Act of 1933 and 1934, which was, enormous regulation. This is what keeps me up at night, because if this is what's actually happening and the markets are deregulating and things are becoming more wild out there, the consumer, the investor, the trader, whatever it may be, has to do a much more due diligent job of monitoring counterparty and systemic risk and some of these other types of risks that maybe we're not accustomed to, because we're entering new ground, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, the CFT could come out and say we have every single one of our attorneys working on this issue, and well, that would be zero people because the last guy quit.
The reason I bring up Chicago is Chicago is the epicenter of the futures markets. I mean, yes, New York is huge, but the Chicago Mercantile Exchange bought the NYMEX and COMEX and so forth. So the Chicago is just light years ahead, especially in the options markets and so forth. So yeah, and you have to remember Chicago also was regarding the poly poly markets, or whatever you call it, with the betting and so forth.
Prediction markets.
Prediction markets and also crypto. And lo and behold, I think you just had the CFTC president, or not president, the chairman of the CFTC came out today, I think it was this morning, talking about how they're getting ready to approve a perpetual crypto futures contract.
Just what
and at the same time, was it Carolyn Pham, who was the CFTC commissioner, that gutted, that was a charge of firing 21% of the workforce with the CFTC. She now works at MoonPay. And so, you have to ask yourself, is this stuff just all coincidence?
Create the situation where the regulators are further gutted and then immediately go work for the people that you just destroyed the regulatory body for. What's the worst thing that could happen? Don't answer that. Oh my God.
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, that was rhetorical. Let me just zero in also, because you've mentioned a couple of times the fall in open interest, and you mentioned that on our Spaces with George Noble on Sunday also. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a big drop in open interest makes it even easier for a big outfit with, say, hypothetically, a big position in SLV to come in and move markets this way, doesn't it? Because a market with fewer participants, the price is going to move more wildly at the margins.
Yes. And that's the problem with depth of the market. Less participants, less depth, and then all of a sudden, the swings get wider. And you have to look at, interesting enough, today GVZ, which is the gold volatility index for GLD, broke out, and it kind of made a higher high. And so you could almost, depending on what happens tomorrow, which would be interesting, is if we reversed higher here, because gold volatility actually was rising today, which is kind of interesting, because typically gold volatility and silver volatility, for that matter, typically go the opposite direction of price. So when usually the price goes down, volatility actually goes down, oddly enough. Unlike the stock market, when prices go down, volatility goes up. So, So you have to look at this market right now, and I think a lot of people are head scratching. They're worried. They see the volatility, and they're asking, "My God, is this going to be January 30th all over again? Or are we going to just get slammed back down, to $70 an ounce? Or am I living basically on this roller coaster ride where we're starting out on the roller coaster? It's going straight up, and you're just about at the nosebleed where it's about to turn and go straight down." I think this market right now is being impacted more by volatility and this lack of liquidity and just this gapping or trading in voids, basically, where the market just doesn't have the depth to sustain any type of balanced price action, I guess you could say.
Now, you've alluded to this in the past. The margin hikes that we saw all through the fall and all in January, the goal, the stated goal, was to restore functioning markets, right, to tamp down the volatility. I mean, that's a quote from 2021, but typically you raise margin to reduce volatility. But in the scenario you're describing here, where the volatility is the result of such low open interest, well, the low open interest has been caused by the margin requirements chasing out those marginal participants here. So the volatility is being created by the margin hikes. Like, the cure is the disease here, isn't it, in this regard?
Yes. Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And what's crazy is, you know, with this increasing margin rates and you know, the exchange maybe trying to do the right thing, you have players that can now take advantage of this with size, and they can push that market around, which in reality usually has the regulators kind of overseeing and supervising the markets. Well, if the regulators are all being fired, who's watching the activity? And this is why I get nervous when I see this type of stuff, because you can come in and you know, whether it's, you know, the president was the working group, I think it was the president has some sort of working group of you know, in the financial markets, you know, they can come in and provide, you know, support to the markets. It used to be when the market went down, they would all get together and, you know, magically the market would levitate higher. But the
pledge
problem
protection
is,
team.
Pledge protective. But the issue that I'm seeing here, though, is there's with less participants, there's an easier way to sort of paint the tape. And that's the part that you, not just as precious metals investor and so forth, because I think we're all kind of used to this idea that, you know, there is a lot of management and potential manipulation in our markets, but there's the same thing in every market. I mean, we like I keep saying, we walk into a casino, you know, and we know the odds are against us, and you know, the casino is going to take full advantage of us, but we still want to play. And that's how I kind of look at the financial markets today, is it's the same mentality. We still want to try to make money in the system, even though the system may be, you know, very managed.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that. And a lot of this is starting to make a lot more sense to me now. And I came into this with way more questions than answers. I got a couple of people I want to acknowledge real quick while we are here. My buddy Travis from Real Estate Mindset. Thank you so much, Travis. He says, thank you for the evening live. We appreciate your tenacity and efforts to get us to the truth. And that was a heaping scoop of it there, Bob, especially the thing with Jane Street and the positions in SLV. And, you know, you really did lay out, with the illiquid conditions, it's totally, totally feasible. And we suspect they're doing it with stocks in India and Bitcoin in the ETF. So it would be silly to think they would not also do it with SLV. And again, none of these things are proven. I guess I got to see CYMIA and talk about the asterisk of these are all accusations and allegations and all that. Yeah. Okay. So an awful lot of allegedlies here. Thanks again, Travis. Nashville Pasta Man. This is interesting. I'd like you to weigh in on this one. I was reading this one earlier. You're quite the diplomat, Bob. So I'll give you a chance to think about this one. Pasta Man is quoting Josh Fair here, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe he's the CEO of Scottsdale Mint. He says, and I love these vague phrases that these guys come up with. Pasta Man is quoting Josh Fair saying, I have a publicly traded company doing paperwork right now. They're adding silver onto their treasury management, and it's a large amount. What goes through your head when you see a phrase like this? And thank you, Pasta Man, for the support of the channel and for passing this on. Bob, give me the clean version. What goes through your head when you see this?
I got a shitload of inventory I need to sell.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry to say that, but this stuff is why even talk about some of the stuff if you don't name names and don't provide any type of, any type of actionable information. You're doing this to try to get people to buy metal, and this is one of the problems I see across the industry. You know, these abstractions of, hey, listen, there's 500 ounces in a Tomahawk missile head, and that's going
that.
To basically.
I hate that phrase. Has anybody held like a monster box of silver in a Tomahawk missile? Did people really think that's true?
I mean, you're really the engineer.
come on, guys. Come on, guys.
I guess maybe it helps. It helps with its downward trajectory once it starts coming from orbit downwards. So
that would be like every paper airplane I made in elementary school. It would hit me in the foot as soon as I released the thing. I mean, it would just nosedive into the ocean. That is a lot of, yeah, there's silver solder and there's silver in the batteries, but 500 ounces. I don't know where that came from. I hear it so much. And the same guy posted that the other day. And I believe he is intelligent enough to know that that is not, in fact, the case. So
maybe they just put a mint box in the front of the warhead.
Yep. It's a, what do you call it? Like a fragmentation warhead. It just sends silver eagles in every direction, leveling everything in its path. It's really quite effective. Blast fragmentation, silver warhead. Sure. Hey, thanks again, Pasta Man. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to weigh in on that. Travis is back again. Okay, this is interesting. What is the bigger factor for silver price movement? Sovereign purchasing. I think he's referring to central banks there. Or paper futures manipulation. Do we exceed 1 SD? I think he's referring to standard deviation in price ever again. So let's attack the first part of that. What do you think is the bigger movement of price right now, the futures market or sovereign banks, central banks buying metal?
Well, if you're talking, ultra short-term movements, the futures markets obviously have an impact. If you're talking about the longer-term picture, the idea of central banks supporting the precious metals, buying, adding to their balance sheet, that is the longer-term picture. That is the win between the wind to the back of the precious metals market. So, the trading side and activity, have to remember most participants don't take physical delivery of futures contracts that they're trading. They're using that futures contract potentially as speculation or as hedging or for other types of purposes. So it's not just simply, I think the central bank theme is much more stronger, on a longer term basis.
Now, real quick, a question is, are central banks buying silver also? I've heard plenty of central bank buying of gold. Do you know of any central banks that are buying silver also?
I don't know. I haven't seen it. It's historically, I don't know why they would, because it's a small market. And obviously, they would start to compete against the industry very, very quickly.
Okay. But the central bank buying of gold would exert an influence on silver price just through the gold to silver ratio, right?
Yes, and being that it's sort of a sister to gold itself, and they move, like you said, from a monetary metal standpoint.
Okay. And thanks again, Travis. I appreciate the support, brother. Dookie, the double D, says, since silver doesn't respond to normal fundamentals, at least today, it sure as heck didn't seem to. Here's an easier question. What has to happen to make the price of silver go up? That's pretty straightforward. What do you think?
I guess it's when it's when everyone least expects it. That's when it'll go back up. And these periods of volatility will start to, we saw this after January 30th, a complete reset in sentiment. We went from euphoria to basically fear overnight. And I think the market is washing out sort of the weak hands, which is basically, people that came in late to the party. Leverage players, the options players, so forth, that stayed too a day too late. That's a positive, because as long as the market is still in an uptrend, still in that bull market, this volatility, all it's doing is resetting the market and resetting the buyers. And it's bringing in short positions into the market potentially that could then lay the seed or the framework for the next move higher. Because you have to remember, especially in the futures markets, it's really the short that moves the price, meaning when they have to get out, they will pay any price to get out. So it's called a forced buy at that point. They don't really get to pick, hey, listen, I'm going to buy it at this price. If it's going up, they're losing money. And they got to cut that.
And, with open interest being so low, I mean, is there any way to quantify how much leverage has been eliminated since that January sell-off? Because obviously way out over its skis in January, a lot of those levered longs have been flushed out. Is that completely done now? We're kind of like back to a level playing field there as far as like the leverage built up equal on the long and the short side?
Yeah, you've had Yep. On average, I mean, we were about 115,000 in open interest as of last night. We were about 162,000 in open interest in terms of contracts in late January. So, say just for simplicity, 40,000 contracts times that by 5,000 ounces of contract. That's a lot of silver positions that have been wiped out. And of course, incrementally, you've seen the roll, the roll go between March and May. A lot of that roll didn't transpire. It didn't roll. The metal just left, which is what you want to see happen as the market is sort of deleveraging and that metal moving to, for example, London, or maybe getting ready to move to India. Who knows? And that's, again, we're trying to identify the next chapter of this market. It's, it's hard to look back and say, well, because this happened in October, this is what's going to force it to go up in January. This is what's going to move it in April or May or whatever it may be. The markets shift and they change, and you have to identify the characteristics of maybe what that next move could be.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Duke, for the super chat there. And I also want to say thank you to Sam Monroe for becoming a new Melonhead member. Welcome, Sam. Thank you for the support of the channel. Now I want to ask you, I want to bring the charts up here. We're gonna shrink us a little bit. And before we get to the charts, I've got to plug Bob's Twitter feed, best feed on X when it comes to precious metals. When I see something happening in metals, this is where I go to look for an explanation. And you've been quiet for the last 2 days, which kind of made me a little nervous. When I see you're quiet on Twitter, I was like, oh boy, something's going on. At Profits Plus ID on X, I highly recommend that. And you're also, I didn't mention this. I was a little lackluster in my introduction today. I apologize, Bob. Bob is the founder and CEO of Idaho Armored Vaults. And I just want to say this is not a paid advertisement. Bob is just donating his time here. So thank you, Bob, for doing that. You've got a really good deal on metal here. And I've been saying on my channel for a while that I think junk silver is a pretty good deal. And I was looking at your website here, goldsilvervault.com, which there's a link down in the description below. You guys have fantastic prices on junk silver here, way back of spot. And I was looking around on finebullionprices.com. You've got the cheapest 90% silver beat by like $2 face. This is a really good deal here. So I'm just going to go ahead and plug this. And again, I'm not being compensated for this, guys, but if you are looking for some metal right now for some physical, the premiums on junk are actually negative because of the situation at the refiners, and really good prices here, Bob. So check that one out.
I appreciate it. Yeah. It's something I've been doing this since 2009, where my business model was always to try to give back to the investor and allow them to make money rather than overcharging on the premiums and building a business model on, hey, listen, how much can I extract from the client? My idea is how much value can I give the client? And that's, being a registered investment advisor, being in the business since 1992, I've never had a complaint on my record as a registered investment advisor, which says a lot because I've been through a lot of bubbles in my life in terms of the markets. This is the difference between working as a fiduciary, that's trying to do the best for the customer versus a lot of the especially the online dealers that I see out there that are really just trying to extract as much premium they can from their product. And that's the unfortunate thing, because a lot of people have vastly overpaid, especially after the big debacle and drop in after January 30th. You were seeing spreads, and they're still this way, $20-$25 spreads between what a big online dealer that says, hey, listen, we do billions of dollars of transactions, yet they have a $25 or $20 spread between almost any silver product. And that's unfortunate, because it doesn't give the consumer a lot of confidence. It says, listen, I buy from you, I have to wait $20 just to break even. That's where the industry is really doing a disservice to itself.
And, by the way, guys, like, in the interest of full disclosure, there's a reason why 90% junk is selling for below spot value, significantly below spot now, because you can't sell it. You're stuck in it if you buy it, because we've got this situation, because there was so much selling last summer when premiums were just absolutely the lowest I've ever seen in my life. Over the summer, the premiums were so low that the dealers were swimming in inventory and they were sending everything to the refiners, all the 3 and 4.9 fine stuff to the refiners to melt down, that the refiners just said, I'm not going to buy junk silver anymore. And so the reason why junk silver is so cheap here is because it's no bid. So if you're looking to like flip this stuff, this is not where you want to be. I'm just of the personal opinion that this dislocation that's currently happening with the refiners is not going to last, and that junk silver is going to correct to the upside significantly, just in terms of premium, let alone whatever the spot price does. I mean, do you differ from me in that regard, Bob, or what do you think is going on with the refiners? Is that going to last much longer?
Well, from what I kind of understand, one of the issues is nitric acid, which is a key component in refining junk silver and sterling and so forth, because there's so many different metals and components that are tied up in this metal. Nitric acid is used to basically sort of separate all this type of stuff. It makes it much easier. Because nitric acid is also used for explosives, you know, the military kind of comes first. Wow. And so what's oddly, you know, with this war going on or this conflict is, if this thing doesn't settle itself down, you know, it may put more pressure on the nitric acid market, which then further pressures the ability to refine, you know, junk and sterling silver. And that's, you know, these are things just to watch out for. It doesn't mean it's, like you said, it may correct itself down the road, and this is, you know, a great entry point to get it to metals, and you're not overpaying, and also you own a product that's basically a part of history, because most of the stuff is, you know, 80 to 100 years old. You know, a lot of it is. So
maybe there's 500 troy ounces of nitric acid in every tomahawk. Did you just accidentally lend credibility to that talking point with your explosives commentary, Bob? Oh, man.
I got a central bank that now is buying nitric acid. The problem I have with the social media is you just see a lot of misinformation. And I think that's also adding to the sort of anxiety that precious metal investors are trying to you know, differentiate, okay, what's really going on. This guy says this, this guy says that. But in reality, sometimes this guy says this so he can sell that. And that's the unfortunate thing about this industry.
And look, I see a lot of people in the comments out of the corner of my eye here. I see a lot of people saying, no junk, it's not liquid. And guys, you're not wrong to say that it's not liquid right now. So, you know, the premise here with buying junk now is that the current liquidity situation is an outlier and it's not going to last. But it is, you're right to point that out. All right. This is not something that you would buy expecting to turn it over in short order and make a profit on. So like this is a very much a buy and hold for the long term. So good call. The melon heads are they think here. Mm-hmm. All right, I promised some charts, and I asked you about this chart a couple of days ago on the spaces with George Noble, and that was two very ugly red candles ago. And we're looking at silver right now. We had the big sell off in January after that monster run. I've shown this a few times on my live streams in the morning. We came up, we had that dead cat bounce to about $92. And then we just broke out on Friday from that level after a failed attempt to break out on the day that the cooling system happened again. And ever since then, we've had, we rejected that level. And now we even gave up the 50-day moving average today. Is there anything, do you see anything good in this chart right now, Bob? Or is this a steer clear?
Well, it's... You have the problem that I have sometimes with the charts, and when you have illiquidity and you have this massive volatility, is you could be developing a range. And sometimes you look too hard into a chart to say, oh my God, it's breaking this level. But in reality, some of these moves are just being, unless the market's being pressed lower for a purpose to break and start a waterfall shed event. Right now, I'm just looking at this as, well, you kind of had this ascending triangle. It kind of broke through that triangle on Friday and now reversed back down, you know, in reality, you're still just caught in this kind of wide range, for the most part. And that's, you don't want to look more into that than just that. I mean, it's, you can look at every squiggle, every moving average, Fibonacci's, all that kind of stuff. You have to allow the market to breathe a little bit. And right now, the volatility ratios are so high right now, and they're staying high. We kind of have to expect just these wide swings. It's frustrating. Trust me, I watch this market every day, and it's, when you're trying to also, manage inventory and so forth, and you're trying to make, a market for clients and buy back metals and that type of thing. Yeah, you're having to deal with this outside volatility. But in reality, right now, you don't want to get too negative just on, a quick 2-day plunge, especially when you have world events going on and you have potentially, where the market is being maybe pushed in a direction to create an appearance, of stability for another asset class, cash, so to speak.
So calm down, Jack. It's $82. I mean, like, let's zoom out on the chart here, and then it gets a lot easier not to panic about the last 2 days when we zoom out on this chart, right? I mean, this time a year ago, I would have begged you for $82. So it's important to keep that in mind. And when we talk about the charts, guys, when we talk about these price swings, we're talking about short-term moves. It doesn't affect the long-term hold proposition for physical metals, right? When we get into the charts and we start looking at intraday swings, that's more for short-term trades versus buying and holding precious metals for the long-term.
Yeah, I mean, because you could almost make the case, right now you're developing, some people may say a bear flag, but you're developing sort of a channel now, where you have, basically where that setting travel is. But if you have series of higher highs and then a little bit of a higher high after that break, that big break. So you're kind of developing a channel there. Again, you're just trying to allow the market to kind of, settle down. The question is, has the fundamental picture changed? Has the story changed at all? And that's something you always ask as a long-term investor. And, as long as we still are going into debt, we're still spending a lot of money. You have structural issues that haven't changed from last week. What you have had basically is a conflict that is, scaring the life out of a lot of people, and obviously creating a lot of disruption in the Middle East with oil prices going higher. That high oil price, people see that and go, okay, is that going to be something that impacts the economy? That high oil price, is that going to be something that impacts, miners' profitability? Because most people may not realize energy is a massive component in terms of expense into the cost of production. So when outlying things happen, the market also has reactive measures to that.
So, you're mentioning the Middle East conflict right now, and, we got a couple of minutes left here. I did come across this article right before we went live about how the grounded flights is stalling gold flows out of Dubai. And I think this probably affects the Asian markets a lot more than it affects, maybe, say, the COMEX or the London market. It may affect the London market more, but have you heard anything about metal getting out of Dubai causing problems or any geographic dislocations resulting from this, or is this just too far removed from our market to really be moving things yet?
I think if you look at it from on the flights side of things, insurance plays an enormous role in the movement of precious commodities, and you saw it with oil tankers and so forth, and European insurance companies, removing or making the cost of insuring that tanker much more expensive, even maybe prohibitively more expensive. Well, the same thing happens in our markets. There are clauses during wartime or conflicts, conflict type clauses, insurrection clauses that are basically exclusions to insurance policies. And so if you get into a situation like, for example, a union strike is an exclusion. Like if you're shipping product across the country and you're using a courier and that courier happens to go on strike that week and the package gets lost, well, that's an exclusion to the policy. Well, when you're having what you call wartime or conflict events happening, all of a sudden that becomes an exclusion if a missile hits a plane and all of a sudden there's, $100 billion of gold sitting in the belly of that plane. So you start to see, the reduction of movement of precious commodities because of the reaction that they or the inability to get insurance to cover that, you know, that shipment. And that's what could be happening here as well.
And Dubai is a pretty important hub for the global gold trade, right? You got a lot of refining happens in the UAE. And is the exchange in Dubai, is that a major player, or is that not really that big of a factor?
There's a lot of metal that goes through Dubai. And it's, it has become a very large player. You know, they service a lot of markets as well. So it's not just simply just the Middle East. You know, there's a metal that goes to India. And of course, a lot of metal that comes out of Africa goes over to Dubai as well. So, it's a very large center for trading.
Okay. Well, Bob, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. And again, folks, you know, especially for some of you folks who joined late, go back and watch that segment about Jane Street. I think that's vitally important to understand. That was kind of a wow moment for me. You know, I've read bits and pieces about the theory, and I read about the Bitcoin story, but, you know, especially in the context of how illiquid and how the open interest is so small right now, it is just ripe for that kind of, I'll just say it, manipulation to be taking place. And I know that's not a word that you ever throw around lightly, so it means more coming from you to hear that, because it's not something that you say on any given Tuesday.
So. Well, and one of the things you'll want to watch for when the next regulatory filings come out is with SLV, is who's, you know, next quarter, who's the largest players. Has the you know, the top 10 holders rearrange themselves again, because, you know, Jane Street came out of nowhere to be the number one holder of SLV. And so, yeah, again, I'm not saying that, you know, not saying at all that they manipulate markets and that type of thing. You know, that's, you know, I don't want to be caught in a lawsuit there, but you know, these types of things, I'm just trying to understand the markets, and I'm trying to say, listen, nothing happened in January, or whatever happened in October did not happen in January. The spreads and borrowing fees and the stress levels were not the same as what happened in October. And all of a sudden, you had a new player come to, you know, there's a new sheriff in town, so to speak.
And was that when Jane Street took out that position during that January run up? Do we know a time frame of when?
Well, they accumulated from, you know, I think the I think that was as of December 31st, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. That Bloomberg filing. So I think that was just a quarterly report. So they were obviously building a position in December, potentially sooner than that. But when you start having, you know, a very sophisticated trading firm that, you know, and they're a lot of smart people work for them. You know, I'm sure they're mathematical geniuses, you know, very, very strong in coding and building, you know, proprietary programs and, you know, all that type of stuff. Well, if you can get volume going into trading volume and so forth, going into a certain, you know, asset, and you own a big portion of that asset, that lends to a lot of potential advantages that maybe, you know, the retail crowd may not be aware of. And that's, you know, and of course, then you have, you know, the stress and the pressures that, you know, the options trading then provide, is that, you know, money attracts money, and then the madness of crowd sets in. And then all of a sudden, you know, dealers who are short calls now have to, you know, start to, you know, they get gamma squeezed, and they start either buying calls, more calls to hedge the calls, or they start buying more underlying, which is normally happens, which actually ends up putting more pressure to the upside on that underlying position. You just got to be able to get the ball rolling, or sort of the snowball rolling down the hill to start the avalanche in a way.
And you nailed that call in 2024, in the beginning of 2024, about the mother of all short squeezes. You still have that pinned tweet. I remember that commentary in some of our spontaneous streams earlier this year about how this smells very different than the run up in the fall. It makes a little bit more sense now. So thanks again for that. I also want to say welcome to our new mod, Frank. Thank you, Frank, for stepping in to help us out at the channel. I appreciate that, everybody. And once again, everybody, thank our mods. It is a thankless job being a moderator on any form of social media now, and our mods do an excellent job, all of them. So thank you guys for everything there. All right, guys, we're coming up on an hour, so we're going to call it there. Once again, check out the links down below to Bob's Twitter feed and to goldsilvervault.com, where you can get fantastic deals on silver. That is not a paid promotion, just a really good deal. Bob, thanks again for your time today. I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your wisdom with us. Everybody else, until next time, live small and dream big.